this morning is Mesberg versus Commissioner of Public Safety. The file number is 821-0578. As all parties are aware, this matter is being recorded, but our internal rules prohibit anyone from recording it on a private matter. So please keep that in mind for anyone who's listening. As counsel for the appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your argument in chief. Counsel for the respondent will have 15 minutes. And finally, counsel for the appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, Mr. Ramsey, please just tell us who you are and you may begin, sir.
Thank you, may it please the court. Counsel, I'm Charles Ramsey and I represent the appellant in this case, Robert Mesberg. Mr. Mesberg appeals the district court's order sustaining his driver's license revocation. The primary issue in this case is to determine what is the legal standard to require a driver to submit to a roadside breath test. To be clear, and contrary to the Attorney General's position, we are not challenging the constitutionality of the statute, but instead are seeking clarification of the legal standard for administration of the preliminary breath test. So the issue is this: if an officer just has reasonable, articulable suspicion that a driver is impaired, is that sufficient to require the driver to submit to a breath test? Or instead, is the standard, the slightly higher standard, probable cause to believe the driving is impaired? Now, before I go on, I do want to discuss the difference or probable cause for what and reasonable, articulable suspicion for what. The court, appellate courts, sometimes have gotten somewhat careless when looking at what we're looking for here, what an officer is looking for here. It is reasonable, articulable suspicion to believe the driver is impaired, or probable cause to believe that the driver is impaired, not reasonable suspicion or probable cause to believe the driver has been drinking. The laws in Minnesota are clear, and this is evidenced by the jury instructions for this, specifically jury instruction 2902. It is not a crime to drink alcohol and then drive. The prohibition is against drinking so much alcohol that it impairs their ability to drive safely. When a person is so affected by alcohol that they no longer possess the clearness of intellect or physical control of themselves that they'd otherwise have, they are under the influence of alcohol. If the alcohol does not affect their clearness of intellect or physical control, then they are said not to be impaired by alcohol, and there is no violation of the statute. The commissioner seems to concede that if the court holds that probable cause is the standard in this case, that it should overturn the trial court. And I base that on the my reading of the commissioner's brief, where I did not find that the commissioner even argued that there was probable cause to administer the PBT. It's Mr. Mesberg's position that not only was there not probable cause to administer the preliminary breath test, but under the very unique facts of this case, there was not reasonable, articulable suspicion to expand the scope of the stop to include the preliminary breath test. We have to look at the totality of the circumstances. In doing so, we can't just ignore those facts that are inconsistent with probable cause, but we have to look at all of them. Here, the officer pulled Mr. Mesberg over for speeding, and he was driving 12 miles an hour over the speed limit, where the speed zone was about to switch from 30 to 40 miles per hour. The officer conceded that he's trained to look at literally dozens of facts when determining whether or not there's probable cause. These include how the driver responded to the officer's lights to stop, how the driver stopped, whether he pulled over in appropriate manner and in a timely manner, how a driver responds to the officer's questions. That also goes to clearness of intellect. Here, the trooper conceded that Mr. Mesberg responded in a manner that was in a way that the trooper would have expected him to respond. I'll concede that at one point, Mr. Messenberg, when asked or answering the question of where he's coming from or where he lives, he said initially, I live by a fire hydrant or a fire department. And on the audio portion of that, he immediately corrects himself. The trial court found that to be of no consequence. In addition, however, the trial court agreed that the usual indicia of intoxication found in most DWI cases are not present here. Contrary to the trooper's conclusion that Mr. Messenberg had slurred speech, the trial court found that Mr. Messenberg's speech was not slurred, and that on two of the three fields.
Mr. Ramsey, assuming, again, speaking for myself and not the panel, that I believe it's not probable cause, but it's reasonable suspicion of impairment. Why isn't speeding at night, the smell of alcohol, and I guess the last one, which is denying he had ever consumed alcohol, under the totality of circumstances, enough to administer a PBT, which can never be admitted into evidence at trial? I mean, some people can pass field sobriety tests and still be drunk. And it's the totality of the circumstances. So why isn't this enough for reasonable suspicion?
Because I think if we were to go that way, Your Honor, we would have to ignore all the facts indicating that Mr. Messenberg was not impaired. So he passed field sobriety tests, right? Two of the three. The other one was inconclusive because the officer did not administer it properly. In addition, however, his speech was fine. He denied drinking. And the officer said he smelled an odor of alcohol, but the trial court specifically found that the officer was not credible. That's not an exact quote, but that's the gist of how the court ruled.
I mean, I think the trial court found that he was not credible in certain respects with respect to the manner in which certain of the field sobriety tests were conducted. But it seems to me that in its ultimate finding, it did conclude that the troopers or the officers detection of the odor of alcohol, he did credit that fact that the officer testified to. Am I mistaken there, counsel?
I think you're right, Your Honor. The trial court does find or rather credit the trooper's testimony that he did smell an odor of alcohol there. That is true.
So I mean, it is, I think that Judge Connolly has targeted the kind of the troubling facts of this case, and that is the detection of the odor of alcohol and then your client's denial of drinking. And those two facts together, coupled with speeding at night, I think we've traditionally considered that to amount to reasonable articulable suspicion such that field sobriety tests can be conducted. Well, is there some contrary authority?
No, Your Honor, but I think I mean, there's no case law directly contrary to that, Your Honor. But again, it goes back to what I started with initially. It's probable cause, or here, under Judge Connolly's question, reasonable articulable suspicion of what? Not to believe that he had been consuming alcohol, but that he was impaired. And so we need to go to his clearness of intellect and look at that. What is there showing that a reasonable officer could articulate suspicion of impairment based on the driver's clearness of intellect? Well, look, he responded appropriately to the lights. He pulled over, he parked properly, and he responded to the officer's questions in a manner that the officer would expect. He followed the officer's instructions on all the field sobriety tests. So when we're looking at clearness of intellect, I think it would be entirely unreasonable for someone to suggest that it was reasonable for the officer to believe that Mr. Messenkomer was impaired when everything shows that he had no impairment when it goes to intellect. And then physically, again, I won't belabor the point about how he responded and stuff. But when he got out of the car, for example, he didn't have to hold onto the door for assistance. When he walked from the side of the car to the point where he performed those field sobriety tests, he didn't trip, he didn't stumble, he didn't fall. When he stood there, he wasn't, as some cases have held, kind of swaying as he was just waiting. There was nothing to indicate whatsoever that he was physically impaired in any way. So other than reasonable articulable suspicion to suspect he had been drinking, yes, I would concede that, but that's not the standard. It's reasonable articulable suspicion to suspect that he was so affected by alcohol that he didn't possess his usual skill, intellect, or physical control. And there's nothing to support that, Your Honor. So that, and this is a very rare case. Most cases, in fact, almost all of them, I don't think have facts such as these, Your Honor. But I'm not conceding that the standard is reasonable articulable suspicion. I think we need to look at recent cases issued by this court. Your Honor, Judge Connolly, you issued the Blawett case.
Yes, yes. And, you know, you can always count on someone to be able to bury you with, to hoist you on your own petard. But, you know, as the state points out, well, first of all, that was clearly dicta. Second, it was a case dealing with, you know, a 1983 action. So I'm not so sure that's reliable, but I certainly concede I said it. So, and I mean, you know, even if it's, you know, the Fourth Amendment applies, well, you know, Terry stops are governed by the Fourth Amendment, and that's reasonable suspicion too. So I don't know if I was so stupid.
But no, you're not.
You're right. I said it. I said it. Okay. So, you know, maybe it's time to retire. I don't know.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not chastising you for writing it. I agree with Your Honor's opinion there. And so I'm using that as support. But you don't stand alone, Your Honor. The court also issued In Re, I think it's DMB, Your Honor. And that also addressed a preliminary breath test. And
again, not in, I mean, it seems to me clearly that was a non-drunk driving related type of case, which I think is what was which was of maximum concern to the court. Again, speaking for myself and not my treasured colleagues. So outside of that, I mean, it seems to me the state pointed to a lot of other cases from various jurisdictions that would seem to say the opposite. So what do you think of that?
Well, both the Blawett case and the TDB from 2018 all say, to be clear, and this is almost identical language, recent precedent indicates that a PBT is a search. And it's relying on Bernard and Birchfield. So both the Minnesota Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court has said that a breath test is a search that invokes the Fourth Amendment. And we're not just talking about a run-of-the-mill roadside pat-down, but we are going
to... explain to me what is so different from a a pat and frisk and a PBT. I mean, they're both, you know, for one thing, the big difference is, you know, if I do a pat and frisk and find a gun, you know, that's admissible. Mm-hmm. If I do a PBT, that's never admissible. So, you know, I guess, I mean, is your argument that, you know, oh, because it's breath, it's very intrusive versus, I don't know. I mean, if someone's frisking me, that seems pretty intrusive to me, you know, maybe I'm getting old. I guess I don't see why. I'm having a hard time seeing why one is the PBT is so much worse than the Terry stop frisk.
First of all, a breath test is intrusive. There's nothing to distinguish, as the trial court said here, intellectually, between a PBT and a DMT at the police station. It's not a passive test where the officer just holds some tester in front of the driver at a reasonable distance to de- protect the air coming out of a driver's mouth as he or she just breathes in and out. It requires deep lung air. And what can be done with that deep lung air is important as well. In fact, because there's no difference between a PBT and a DMT, as the U.S. Supreme Court said, that it does require probable cause. We can now look at a driver or a person's breath and determine lots of things. For example, are they diabetic? We can determine acetone, that sort of thing. So if we can determine if the driver has these kinds of medical conditions, it does invoke those privacy concerns. I see my time is up and I'll yield to Mr. Young. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You will have rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Young, whenever you're ready, sir.
Thank you, and good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is William Young. I'm here on behalf of the Commissioner of Public Safety. At the outset, just want to reiterate, a PBT, it is a search. There's no dispute that it's a search, but it is a reasonable search under the Fourth Amendment. This court has held so repeatedly over time, and nothing in the recent U.S. Supreme Court case law has changed that analysis. In fact, Birchfield discussed PBTs briefly in the fact section and seemed to cast no aspersions on the use of them. There was a recent statement that there's no difference between a PBT and a DMT. Judge Connolly has hit the nail on the head several times with his questions that is absolutely incorrect. A PBT is not an evidentiary test. There are many more protections in place after an arrest as established. And so because the PBT is just done to confirm or dispel suspicions on the side of the road, it is not a very intrusive test. It's over in a matter of seconds. It is a reasonable test when you balance the legitimate government interest in protecting the safety of the highways and of the traveling public against the dangers of drunk drivers compared to the very minimal intrusion into a driver's privacy to request that test.
Mr. Young, can we address Mr. Ramsey's argument, which is, in this case, there are three circumstances that the district court found justified the taking of the PBT: that he was speeding, that the trooper smelled alcohol on his breath, and that he denied drinking. What about those three facts is indicative of impairment? I think that this is really the crux of the case, right? Why are those three facts enough to provide reasonable, articulable suspicion that this person is impaired by alcohol within the meaning of the law?
Yes, Your Honor. The district court, when it made its different credibility determinations, it did, in the second paragraph total of the memorandum, really got tied up to the fact that despite the strong odor that the district court found the trooper credibly smelled, Mr. Messenberg's denial of consuming alcohol in the face of that strong odor seemed to really suggest to the district court that that would tip off to an objective police officer, I need to investigate further because I'm smelling the odor of alcohol. There's nothing illegal about simply consuming alcohol, but the fact that he is denying it despite the obvious strong odor, that should raise the radar of a typical law enforcement officer in which they should investigate further. Why is he misleading me in spite of what I'm obviously smelling and seeing and observing?
So you're saying if he had admitted that he had consumed alcohol, then this case would be over?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. It's a totality of the circumstances test for each specific case. But in this case, that is one of the totality that seemed to really trigger additional investigation. Now, we also have the fact that it was speeding, but it was 1:43 on a Sunday morning after Halloween had just ended.
Okay, but isn't that a separate question? Because no matter how he would have answered that question, you would still be saying that there was under the totality of the circumstances. So that question is really kind of irrelevant, isn't it?
Well, it's relevant in that the fact that he answered untruthfully in spite of the obvious evidence to the contrary, it further suggested to the trooper possibly consciousness of guilt and he was trying to hide it. Who knows what, but it goes into, that's why the answer to the question was asked, and the answer plays into the totality, but it's not necessarily the only factor that defines it.
I understand that, but if he had answered, yes, I've been drinking, that certainly would have triggered a stronger articulable suspicion than denying it, wouldn't it?
Well, I agree that if he had answered yes, the trooper wasn't going to immediately let him leave. He would still have conducted an investigation. I don't know what would have played out from that point forward. But the denial in the face of the obvious drinking definitely contributed to the trooper's interest in pursuing the further investigation to clarify whether Mr. Messenger was impaired. But I do agree that, yes, there was no answer to that question based upon the strong odor that was probably going to immediately terminate the encounter.
Okay. Thank you.
And so this court has considered the issue of the preliminary breath test many times and found that the reasonable basis standard in Minnesota law is similar to reasonable suspicion. And it has also considered cases in which it then interpreted whether probable cause existed when a PBT was not administered because it was refused, or as well as if a PBT is properly requested based upon that reasonable suspicion. We cited to the multitude of cases this court has previously considered, but they all ultimately tie back to the Minnesota Supreme Court in Jensuski, and before that in Marbin and Grovem, where they say the whole purpose of a preliminary breath test is for an officer to confirm or dispel the suspicions, which is exactly what ultimately came here. When the trooper asked, "Will you take the test?" he was attempting to confirm or dispel his suspicions. And that test request was based upon the totality of circumstances, the reasonable suspicion that existed at that moment based upon the observations, the reasonable observations known to the officer at that time. I'm looking at the other questions that were asked of Mr. Ramsey before. Judge Connolly, I think you again sort of keyed in on the fact that Blowett and TDB were not cases that are directly on point here. They're not really even reviewing PBTs that are administered pursuant to the Minnesota statute. They're PBTs that were administered in a different context, and that's why there was a higher standard or a different standard applied versus the one applied here for the probable or the preliminary breath test statute in Minnesota law for drivers who are possibly impaired, who are suspected of being impaired by the officers. I would note that throughout Trooper Elwood's testimony, he mentioned at each stage, "I suspected that Mr. Messenberg was impaired." It wasn't that he was curious. He kept saying, I suspected all the way along. Even when he requested the PBT, he had that suspicion of a possible impairment, and he was just, again, attempting to confirm or dispel those suspicions. So it could have been inculpatory or exculpatory.
So aren't you really saying that the smell of alcohol and the speeding is enough for articulable suspicion? Is that what you're saying?
Well, again, it's a totality test, Your Honor, but in this case, with the strong odor, the speeding, the time of day, the denial of drinking, it was enough in this case to have reasonable suspicion to make that request. But in each case, it's going to be totality based upon the observations. An officer, a reasonable officer, it's an objective test. But here, that test was met based upon the criteria as found by the district court, known to the officer at the time he made the request. I see no other questions. I'd be happy to yield the rest of my time unless there are any other questions. I would just ask this court to affirm the district court.
Mr. Young. Mr. Ramsey, sir, you'll have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to address the parade of horribles that the Attorney General argues that will ensue if this court finds or holds that probable cause is the proper standard. All we need to do is look at Bondrachek for an example that demonstrates that this will not materially affect police enforcement's ability to keep drunk drivers off our roads. In Bondrachek, we had a driver who was speeding. There was an odor of alcohol and they admitted drinking, but they failed the field sobriety test. This court found that that was sufficient to form probable cause to arrest. In most cases, we will have that. We'll have failure of field sobriety tests. We'll have slurred speech. We will have unsteadiness when a person's standing there. So this court found that the PBT in that case was immaterial. But furthermore, most drivers, when asked by a police officer to submit to a PBT, will give their consent. And so we will either have, and sometimes both, probable cause to arrest without a PBT, or the driver will voluntarily consent to submit to a PBT. It's a very rare case where we have insufficient information to demonstrate impairment, and also that coupled with the driver's refusal to waive his constitutional rights and submit to a unconstitutional search. The court earlier indicated that it was no big deal having to submit to a breath test at the side of the road. Because of the limited use of that breath test. But it's a privacy concern. What if the legislature asked the driver to submit a sample of their saliva at the drive of the, at the side of the road? Well, we can use that saliva to determine all kinds of conditions. What if the officer was allowed to collect DNA at the side of the road? We all know what DNA can be used to reveal and the privacy concerns implicated. Limiting the use of that search, I don't think comes into play here. It's the search itself, the search of the deep lung air that changes this from a reasonable articulable suspicion standard to a probable cause standard. As the trial court said, there's really no difference between a breath test in one case and a breath test down at the police station. Therefore, I would ask respectfully that this court hold that the breath test is a search invoking the Fourth Amendment and that probable cause is the standard, and that a driver who has a right to refuse that unconstitutional search cannot or his decision not to consent to a test cannot be used to form probable cause for arrest. And I would ask that this court overturn the trial court's order sustaining the license revocation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ramsey. Thank you very much, Mr. Young. The matter is submitted and we will be issuing our decision within 90 days. That being our last oral argument of the day, we are adjourned.